This podcast is a Uniting Heart and Soul production. Hello and welcome to Filthy Hope, a podcast from Uniting Heart and Soul in Woollahra, all about choosing hope and faith in the middle of the realness of life. We've been spending our first stretch of the podcast asking the question, where the fuck is God, amidst some of life's hardest challenges, and today we're finishing up that stint in a slightly different format. This week we're looking at climate catastrophe, through the lens of Paul Schrader's 2018 film, First Reformed. First, a warning, both that we're going to be spoiling this film in its entirety, but also that it tackles heavy themes, including abortion, suicide, climate catastrophe, and terrorism. As such, our discussion is also going to be touching on some of those themes. So if these sections of the podcast feel too heavy for you or are making you feel uncomfortable, feel free to skip through them. As usual, we are also going to be taking our mission statement of radical honesty very seriously, which means that you're probably going to hear some swearing at different points in the podcast. And while this is our final episode of Where the Fuck is God for now, we are continuing next week with our first episode in a new series about intimacy and sexuality, so stay tuned for that. And who knows, we could very well be revisiting Where the Fuck is God at a later date, because we know how much we have enjoyed having these discussions. But for now, please enjoy this week's discussion about climate catastrophe and the film First Reformed. Ness, welcome to the podcast.
Oh my gosh. Oh, that movie, man.
So we, how long ago? Probably, what, 20 minutes?
Yes.
Just finished watching First Reformed, which hopefully you might have had a chance to watch before listening to this. If not, we will give it a quick recap, so don't worry. But a spoiler warning as well. We will be talking literally all the way up to and including the end of the movie. So if you don't want it spoiled, don't listen. We're going to spoil the crap out of it. But first reactions, how are you feeling having just watched that movie?
Oh, I think I'm perplexed, because as we had a little bit of a conversation afterwards, I think my initial cuppa full reaction to the ending was relief. I felt huge relief after watching this trauma unfold in this guy's life. And yet then in discussions with you afterwards, you said, but what about this? And I went, oh, shit, no, Jonty. No, I like my ending so much better. So I think, I don't know, I sort of must create a Disney ending for myself so that it feels like an hour and a half of trauma ends quite well for me. But I think that that's indicative of my life and how I actually do living. But how you talked about the ending, and now that I've had a read of what the critics have said, I've gone, wow, okie doke. I could entertain your thoughts on that.
Yeah, it's interesting. We'll get into this, but my reading of the movie is that the ending can be read in a couple of different ways, and both are valid and both are represented in the text itself. Like there's representation and stuff in the movie that qualifies either reading, which I think is very interesting, and we'll get into that. Before we dive in, though, I might just do a really quick recap.
Awesome.
Just so if people don't want to watch the movie or haven't been bothered, so they kind of know what we're talking about. So the movie's called First Reformed, written and directed by Paul Schrader. I believe it came out in 2018. It follows Ethan Hawke as a minister, a pastor at a small church called First Reformed in New York, which is right next to Abundant Life is what it's called, isn't it?
The mega church.
The mega church next door. And he is approached by a congregation member, Amanda Seyfried, who wants him to talk to her husband, who is going through some stuff. He goes and meets with him. The husband, Michael, talks to Ethan all about his climate activism work, and asks the really tough question. Amanda Seyfried is pregnant. Reverend, how can you possibly sanction bringing new life into this world? It's going to shit. He goes through all the different statistics about, you know, in 2050, within our lifetime, within our potential children's lifetime, this world is going to go to shit. How can you, in all good conscience, sanction bringing new life
And he makes that comment, Jonty, where he says, and you know if your child says to you, but Dad, you knew that this was happening, why didn't you do anything about it? Mm. It was quite disturbing. And I think we also need to make mention that Michael's character's just spent time in jail for climate change activism. So we know that he's a bit radical on the edge and he's pushing the boundaries, certainly of the law, for him to do some time.
Yes. The other important thing is that the First Reformed Church is coming up to its 250th anniversary, so there's a big ceremony, a recommissioning, is that what it was?
Yeah, reconsecration.
That's the one. So that's in the background as well. Their second meeting gets postponed. Michael postpones and tells him to meet him on a walking trail the next day. When he does turn up, he has killed himself. Mm. So then sort of shifts to the relationship between Ethan Hawke and Amanda Seyfried as they work through that grief.
Very graphic scenes if you're not into that. Just warning about that super confronting imagery.
Mm-hmm. We then discover that Michael has hidden a suicide vest, a bomb in the house, which Ethan Hawke takes to dispose of, so it's not in the house when the police go through and blah, 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 whatever. We then move forward to preparing for the reconsecration, and Ethan Hawke's character is essentially going through a crisis of faith anyway. He's drinking a lot, he's writing a journal, putting all of his thoughts down. Not only all of the stuff with the climate, he's suddenly confronted with all these questions that he has to wrestle with, but then also being a first-hand witness of that tragic trauma and the tragic death, he starts to spiral. He then crucially discovers that one of the worst offenders of pollution in the United States is this energy company, the CEO of which is a co-fundee of the megachurch next door.
A major benefactor, in fact.
And will be there at the reconsecration. Mm. Long story short, we get to the day of the reconsecration, and he is planning to detonate the jacket which he has found and kept in an act of protest at the reconsecration. He tells Amanda Seyfried not to come. He doesn't tell her why. He's got the vest on. He's about to go in and do the thing, and then he sees that Amanda Seyfried has showed up, so he panics, takes it off, goes to drink a glass of Drano to commit suicide. But then Amanda Seyfried bursts in. He drops the glass. They embrace. The camera swirls around them. End of movie. So the first thing we need to discuss...
And they do a massive pash.
Yes, they...
So they are very connected. It comes as a bloody relief, quite frankly.
So the first thing we need to discuss is the ending. Because the whole film, and if you go back and watch it again, there's lots and lots and lots of breadcrumbs dropped leading to this moment where he is going to become a martyr in his eyes and commit suicide while blowing up the church in protest. The barbed wire, which I didn't mention, shows up a couple of times. The Drano shows up very early on when he's clearing the toilet. So we were talking earlier about, you can read this film in two ways. Either he does actually commit suicide at the end, and what we see at the end is this ecstatic moment of relief going through, playing out in his brain in a very hyper stylized way.
Maybe at the point of death.
Exactly. Mm. Or Amanda Seyfried does actually stop him from committing suicide, and what we see is actually happening in front of our eyes. The interesting thing about the movie is that, like I already said, both readings are valid within the movie. There's evidence within the movie that supports both interpretations.
And isn't it interesting that you and I have polarised interpretations, and I wonder if this is why you wanted me to be on this podcast with you, because you damn well knew that I would pick the Disney ending.
I suspected,
Is it a chick thing, do you think?
Oh, maybe, maybe. I think it's probably a just a life experience thing as well, I think. But I guess the first thing I wanted to talk about is like, why did we watch this movie? Why do you think, like, what is in this movie for us to talk about that's interesting? And I think the first thing that we could talk about is the environmental element. So Michael, the character of Michael, is a climate activist, and is clearly, well, he's struggling with the question of, my wife's pregnant, but I can't in good conscience bring a new life into this world. What were your initial, like, how do you feel about the climate element of this movie?
Oh, I just agree. I 100% agree with him on his passion for climate and his frustration with the world and what we're not doing. I fully empathise with that. I don't empathise with the radical steps that somebody would take to put themselves into harm's way for any cause, whatever that is, unless, of course, a pedophile's hurting my child, and then I would, you know, arc up big time. But definitely the climate piece. I think what's interesting is how they depict the church's reaction to the climate conversation, because there's that scene between the senior minister in the mega church, Abundant Life, and then you've got the Ethan Hawke character minister, Reverend Toller, and those two ministers meet together and they meet with the benefactor.
I've forgotten the gentleman's name. Yeah.
And they meet and they have lunch together, and Ethan Hawke's character starts arcing up about climate and how can we be the church when we know that we're destroying creation? What the hell would God say about this? Mm-hmm. And he gets shut down by the senior minister. That's what I think is hilarious. Just shuts him right down.
We don't need to get into anything political.
That's the one. Yeah. And then I think it cuts very carefully to seeing some balance sheets. So we're seeing where the money and the donations are going. So it becomes abundantly clear that this gentleman is definitely paying off the church to be supportive of what they're doing, polluting the world. So I think that's a major red flag for us. And I think there are... I know myself, just in my own area, I had a conversation with a minister who was horrified by the fact that we're carrying on, in inverted commas, about climate change, and just let it be. It's not for us to worry about. What a palaver. And I thought, you asshole, is what I thought. He described them as right-wing, mung bean-eating, alfalfa sprout-sniffing lefties. And, I was just to hear that from a colleague just broke my heart, Jonty. A minister spoke like that. And I thought, wow, mate, are we not in the same planet here together?
I think what's really compelling about the movie, though, is that it depicts both the side of that argument that I think we're on, the side of, well, of course we should be looking after this planet that has been gifted to us. But then it also, like, it doesn't pick a side, because there's a moment which I was struck by when rewatching this again, where Reverend Toller is in the office of the lead pastor of Abundant Life. And he says, do you really think it's God's plan to destroy this earth? And without blinking, the lead minister responds, well, he's done it once already. He did it in 40 days and 40 nights.
Oh, my gosh.
And I was like, I could picture a shittier version of this movie where the movie is so clearly on Reverend Tuller's side of, like, we need to, you know, pull up our socks and look after the planet. But it's actually a much more complex... It trusts the audience to consider both sides, which I think is really bold and ballsy, because with anything, if it's a novel or a film or whatever, allowing the audience or giving them the trust to actually interpret and read into the text without kind of removing the authorial voice from it and saying, here's what these characters are discussing. Yep. I'm going to represent them truthfully on both sides. Something to consider instead of preaching at you, which I think is really, really, really bold.
Yeah, 100%.
And compelling.
Yep.
Yeah. What's the difference then between... I mean, and we can track Reverend Toller's progression through the film sort of as a marker. What's the difference between being an extremist, they use that language in the film a couple of times, and just being passionate about something that you believe in, which is a dangerous question, right?
Mm.
Because I don't think extremists would call themselves extremists. I think they would just call themselves people that are passionate about what they believe in and will do anything that is required to carry out that vision.
I think when it involves hurting other people or hurting yourself, that's definitely, that's extremism taken to the extreme, isn't it? That's just, and that's depicted in this film, 100%. I mean, we can be vocal and passionate about what grinds our gears, but to actually go and hurt others in the name of that passion, I think is where you draw the line. I get it though. I absolutely get it. And there's only one thing I would be extreme about ever, and it would, and I alluded to it earlier, is if somebody hurt my child. I will fuck you up if you hurt my kid. And there'll be no questions asked. It'll be not a good day. I'll be in green. I'll be wearing that green tracksuit, mate. You know, I just think that... So I do understand people's extreme passion. I get it.
Especially, you know, with this film being about climate.
Yeah.
I'm listening to this guy, Michael, you know, spill his beans to Reverend Toller at the beginning in that counselling session and kind of going... Yeah, I agree with everything this guy's saying.
He did.
I don't think... Well, I think something that the film does really well is Toller's actions towards the end of the movie aren't ever depicted as this is the right thing to be doing.
No.
In fact, I think it's almost... You can look at this as like, in a traditional sense, a tragedy. Because... This is the other element that we really do need to talk about, is he has no networks. He has no support. He has no one to talk to or lean on, and he actually actively pushes those people away that are there to try and help him. And, you know, I actually think that when we talk about climate catastrophe and particularly with young people... It's impossible to separate climate catastrophe with a sense of despair or depression or meaninglessness or hopelessness, because the reality is that within the lifetime of young people, the world will be a very different place, and expecting people to just be okay with that is a little bit absurd. But I think, when we were talking about this earlier, that regardless of how you think the ending of the film plays out in a literal sense, Toller finds his quote-unquote salvation through accepting other people into his life.
That's if you believe the ending. My version of the ending. Otherwise, he's just drainoed himself, mate. He's gone to, you know, be with God, I'd like to think. But I think from a ministry perspective, I think all my reverends out there that are listening to this, my mates, they need to watch this, because it speaks to ethical ministry. And in the Uniting Church, we do a whole lot of training regularly on ethical ministry. And this dude, this character, he had so many red flags going on. We never saw that he was having any supervision or that he had any colleagues that were able to confide in. He had nobody close to him. He was just seemed like he was working around the clock. You never saw him do anything other than drink too much and then start mixing his bourbon with his Drano. The guy was suffering post-traumatic stress after the death of his kid. His marriage had imploded. He was a single man, and he was on a a self-harm track, and we see it play out. And I think in ministry, it's a really bloody lonely business at times.
Mm.
And he didn't have any support whatsoever.
And the support that was offered to him, he just rejected.
Totally.
It's that scene where he just dresses that... Esther?
Is that it?
Yeah.
Gives it
so
to
the
her.
Implication is that they've been having an affair.
Yeah.
She works at Abundant Life.
Choir mistress.
That's it, yeah.
Beautiful girl.
And there's a moment where he's just been to the hospital to get a checkup, and they're wanting to do more tests and suspecting bowel cancer and things like that, which you actually brought up the option that I hadn't even considered, that he was actually already self-harming through drinking Drano with the bourbon, which was contributing to his stomach issues. But she rings up to the hospital and hears that he's having these pretty hectic tests and says, you need help. You need to start looking after yourself. And he dresses her down and just gives it to her.
Like it was confronting to listen to, wasn't it?
Yeah. And just, he literally says, I despise you and everything that you make me into. That level of just absolutely getting stuck into her.
It was awful.
And she's the one person that is offering any real support or help to him.
Oh, I believe she really loved him, wanted a relationship with him, and he's just pushed her away.
Mm.
You know, it's just devastating.
Mm.
And that was indicative of his mental health issues, I believe.
Mm. Mm. We should talk about Mary.
Oh, how good was she?
So Mary is Amanda Seyfried's character. Paul Schrader being a Catholic, I think, is also important, in discussing this, because Mary's character is pregnant. And like I said earlier, I think the key to understanding what the movie is about is Mary's entrance right at the end. And I think the parallels between Mary and the Virgin Mary are really important, not in a literal sense. I think Paul Schrader is much more smart and intelligent than that, but Mary being pregnant, and also his Reverend Tuller's son's name being Joseph, I think are very intentional choices. I guess I'm still sort of rolling through in my brain what that actually means in a practical sense of what we're meant to take away from her character being named Mary. But I think regardless, it's through her character that he finds that sense of connection and the only really meaningful conversations and moments of human connection that he has is with her character, which, like you said, kind of goes against all ethical ministry training, and there's a bunch of red flags going up all the way along that track.
John T, I wonder if Michael, the husband of Mary, he was doing the whole conversation about what would God think? What would God think? We're ruining the world.
Will God ever forgive us?
Will we ever be forgiven? It was just very, very heavy. It was like he was the conscience of God. And shut me down if I'm going too far, but I wonder if, so the conscience of God has impregnated Mary, and maybe the saviour is going to be this child that's born of Mary. I wonder if that connection was a part of the plot or the twist or the thinking.
Well, I definitely do think that Mary being pregnant is important, and not only that, but Michael not being willing to commit to carrying through the pregnancy. I think that idea of allowing hope in through the literal within the literal nature of the movie, the pregnant Mary, but I think that's representative of just in there is no hope in Michael's mind of the world or society progressing in any meaningful way, which is why he commits suicide essentially.
Total despair.
Yeah, and one of the my favorite quotes in the film is, there can be no hope without despair.
Yeah.
It's about holding those two contradictory truths together, because they cannot be one without the other, and life is about holding hope and despair together.
That's it. That's what he says.
Yeah.
And there was even the contemplation of abortion early on, mm-hmm. wasn't there?
Yeah.
I can't remember who brought it up. I think it might have been Michael.
Well, it's Michael, yeah.
Michael did, yeah.
Because he doesn't want to bring a child into the world, yeah.
And so there was kind of this innuendo that Reverend Toller, the Ethan Hawke character, talks him out of encouraging Mary to have an abortion. And so he chooses to kill himself.
And part of that is because we learn that Reverend Toller had a child as well.
Yeah, that's right.
Who went off to war and died. And he had encouraged the son to go off and do that because he used to be in ministry in the army, and his ex-wife didn't want him to go.
That's right. And then he died.
And then he died. And then the marriage didn't last after that. So, and he says the pain you're feeling now about, you know, the despair and the pain about bringing a child into the world is nothing compared to the pain of losing a child.
Yeah, that's right.
And he says that from a place of
knowing.
I've been there, mate.
Yeah, it was heavy, wasn't it?
Yeah. So I'm feeling like that pregnant Mary thing is kind of about accepting hope and allowing that hope to continue through the despair. Almost, that sounds cheesy as fuck.
No, it's not cheesy. I think it's the undergirding factor of the whole movie.
Mm.
It is the hope of the new life, and the child's going to be born into this world where climate change is a thing, and what is going to be for that child in 2050?
Mm.
You know, rising sea waters, all the things that we talk about with climate change. It's frightening.
Well, and something that I'm wrestling with at the moment as we're talking is like, I struggle to think about like what if he had gone through with detonating the vest, it wouldn't have done anything.
No.
He would have killed
a whole bunch of people.
A couple hundred people.
That's right.
It's not going to affect anything in terms of the climate catastrophe. And so it's just sort of there's that realization that you have at a certain point where, you know, obviously in terms of climate, you know, recycle your bottles and switch your light switches off, and but at the end of the day, it's big corporations that contribute, what was it, like 80 to 90% of the world's pollution. And so climate activism, obviously the individual things are super important, but being that selfish and that blinded by despair to take that out on other people in an attempt to, I guess, draw attention to the fact that this church is funding a corporation that's one of the world's biggest polluters.
But they got probably their organ fixed, Jonty.
I did laugh at that quite a bit.
250-year-old organ, and the biggest polluter in the region funds that beautiful organ to be fixed.
Yeah, good on him. Good on him.
Amen.
Yeah.
And there was this beautiful quote that he says at one point, who's going to stand up and save the earth?
Yeah.
And that's the question, isn't it?
Mm.
Who is?
Yeah, I remember, and won't drop names, obviously, but our mutual friend who I was in a meeting with on Friday, shout out because he's probably listening, had to duck off early to capture photos at a climate rally in Town Hall. Which the Uniting Church in Australia is very present at
100%
every time those happen, because they happen pretty frequently, once or twice a year. You know, I couldn't tell you exactly what the one-to-one benefit of going to those sorts of things are, but it's that sort of thing. Like, well, if we're going to do something, you got to start somewhere.
And a colleague of mine made reference to the Uniting Church Pitt Street signage on climate change as how horrified he was at the scare tactics the Uniting Church use in regards to climate change.
Yeah.
You know, because frightening, Jonty.
Yeah. And
I think that feeds into that whole thinking that climate change is just a part of God's plan. Because that was mentioned in there as well, wasn't it?
Yeah.
You know, it's just part of the plan.
You reckon it's God's plan to destroy the world? And then he says, well, he's done it before.
Yeah.
Why won't he do it again? And that, which is a really confronting idea, because I'm super convicted that where we've been given this planet to look after and steward.
Mm.
And the idea that climate catastrophe is part of God's plan, I kind of go...
And like, he tied in climate catastrophe with disease and illness and
they mentioned epidemics,
viruses,
which
epidemics,
was interesting. Yeah,
the whole thing.
A few years before the pandemic, yeah.
You know, like the world's going to shit and it's all a part of God's plan. Well, I don't know what kind of God they worship, whoever says that shit.
Mm.
It's not the God that I worship.
Well, and it was interesting. The lead pastor says to Reverend Toller, like, dude, you are always in the garden. Not even Jesus was always in the garden, like on his knees, sweating blood. Like he was in the temple. He was out with the people. He was eating with people. He was that really struck me because I've, as we've talked about before on this podcast, had some pretty hectic mental health issues in the past. That really struck me as like kind of like a real kick up the ass to be like, dude, it's totally up to you to not let whatever it is that you're going through stop you from going out and doing what you need to do.
Mm.
That's not to say that being depressed or being, quote, in the garden, they're talking about the Garden of Gethsemane in the Passion story, where it says that Jesus was, depending on which version you read, grieved to the point of death. Like, if that's not depression, I don't know what is. Not even Jesus was always in the garden. And I wasn't... I'm still not quite sure how to read like that, if that's an ironic statement where we're meant to be shocked by how blunt of a statement that is, or if there's actually something in there that Schrader might feel convicted about. I don't know. But that was just a really interesting
I shuddered
idea.
When I heard that.
Yeah.
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 I had a reaction. Most definitely.
Yeah.
Too much of this movie, quite frankly.
It's pretty intense. Yeah.
Highly recommend it.
It's bloody brilliant. Mm. I don't know if there was anything else you wanted to talk about. I've got a couple of other things. But
yeah, go.
Yeah. The style, we haven't really talked about the film itself. We've talked about the ideas in the film. But Paul Schrader's a really interesting filmmaker. We were talking, he wrote Taxi Driver. He's written a stack of films, but most famously, Taxi Driver was his first big hit. But he's also written a book called Transcendental Style in Film. And you mentioned, before I'd even mentioned this book, wow, this film... What did you say? It was something about...
Well, there's that scene.
Transcendent.
Yeah. They have this scene where Amanda's character says to Ethan Hawke, when Michael was here, we would lay on each other fully clothed and we would just have complete body contact and we would breathe in rhythm together.
Yeah.
And so you see this scene of them doing that and you can watch them. It's beautifully done, actually. And then you see this different type of cinematography happen.
Mm.
And do you want to maybe talk about that? But I described to you at the time that it looked like transcendental meditation.
Yeah.
And I thought, I wonder if that's what he was trying to portray there.
Yeah. So when he talks about transcendental style in film, it's like, I'll paraphrase this and butcher it. And Paul Schrader is obviously a much more articulate and knowledgeable man than I am. But he talks about, because he's a Catholic, but also not only makes films, but has been a critic of cinema, like wrote in newspapers about film since he was 16 or something ridiculous. And he talked about finding a bridge between his spiritual life as a Catholic and his film life as someone interested in film. And he talks about discovering that bridge wasn't a bridge of content, it was a bridge of style. And so the way that films are cut and edited and presented and shot in the technical sense. So he talks about a bunch of other filmmakers like Ozu and Bresson and getting too niche here. Be a little bit more practical, but he so what that means is with a film like this, there's lots of camera on a tripod, has the entire room within the frame, often center frame, very nice and symmetrical. Characters will sit down and they'll just talk. The camera won't cut. Character will get up and leave, go make some tea or something. Instead of cutting into the other room, the camera will just stay there.
And you hear their voices.
And it's still.
It's clever.
And it just leaves everything room to breathe.
Mm.
And he talks about the word boring, and not in a negative, I'm so bored of this movie, but like in real life, we have those spaces, we have those moments because our lives aren't edited into 90-minute packages that are compelling and exciting. Life is boring sometimes. And having scenes that have that quote-unquote boringness, which means that the film is very, very slow in an editing sense. There's not many cuts. There's lots of space for scenes to breathe. There's gaps between dialogue where people just pause, which makes that moment when they do the lying on top of each other thing and they suddenly fly off through the cosmos.
Levitate.
And there's reprojected images of the environment behind them. Really, like, it's kind of absurd anyway, but within the context of a film that is so dry and so precise and so slow, it's even more ridiculous, not in a critical way, but it pops out at you as like, what on earth is going on? Because it starts with one of these shots that just stays. She lies on top and we hear them breathing. And we
take off.
Couple of insert shots on the hands as they touch, and then they just start lifting off the floorboards. And you're like, what on earth is happening? All of a sudden, we cut to they're flying through space.
Yeah.
And I think this is important because the same thing happens right at the end, if we go full circle back to the ending. When Amanda Seyfried's character Mary comes in, all of a sudden they embrace, they're kissing each other, and the camera swirls around them in 360 degrees a bunch of times, cut to credits.
This is why it's a Disney ending, Jonty. Because it's exactly, he's got that connection there with the touching, the physical and the spiritual connection. He becomes alivened in that moment. And I think in seeing her, he's given her that, she has given him that aha moment that has just triggered his PTSD mind and catapulted him right into the present, not into the past of the trauma of the death of his own child, and he's triggered right back into the here and now, and he is psychologically recalibrated in that moment, drops his Drano, embraces in a passionate love thing, and we see that beautiful swirling. Oh, I'm so much happier now.
But and I think that's really key because the film gives you all the tools to read it in that way.
Totally.
But more importantly, I think, is yes, you can read it that way. You could read it the other way. But either way, that is signifying exactly that. He's found that interpersonal connection, that spiritual connection, and the movie, without that ending, is kind of just this, I mean, it's pretty depressing anyway, but without that salvation, quote-unquote, at the end, it's just about a guy spiralling until he hits the bottom.
And you know, I thought about the colour, and I mentioned it to you while we were watching it. It was all these muted tones. Yeah. There was no colour. You know, the only time there is a pop of colour is in the death scene of the guy when he blows his head off.
Yeah.
That's the only time you see deep red blood, and you see it then again, spots of red blood on his robes.
With the barbed wire.
The barbed wire. But you never see a pop of colour.
No, anywhere. It's very muted.
It's muted, the whole grey wash tones of everything, isn't it?
Yeah.
It speaks of major depression.
Oh, totally, totally. Yeah. And Schrader's spoken a lot. There's a really great, I don't know if you've seen The Hollywood Reporter do these roundtable discussions. They put them up on YouTube. They're about an hour long. They do roundtables with actors and producers and screenwriters and directors right around the time of release. There's a director's, or is it writer's? I think it's actually a writer's roundtable with a bunch of great writers, including Bo Burnham, who's we should talk about. I just had an idea. We'll talk about his most recent comedy special on a pod. But one of which is Paul Schrader, and he talks about, I think the question, because I have a host, and the host says, because they're talking about, Bo Burnham says, you know, we're in a culture that's aging like milk. And the question is sort of, what's the impetus to get up and write in the morning then? And Paul Schrader speaks directly to a lot of it, it's out of loneliness and depression. He feels compelled. It's almost like a form of therapy, is, you know, and that's why it's, I in some senses, I always feel like the death of the author is really important in reading whatever it is that you're encountering, whatever work it is. But I think knowing the voice behind this film is really important because he's a deeply conflicted Catholic.
Mm. It's very helpful.
That has gone through a lot, and you can see it through the work. Taxi Driver is a film about loneliness. Mm. He talks about that. You come up with a good metaphor for loneliness. A taxi driver and a taxi in New York, you run the metaphor all the way through, roll credits. Like it's so that sense of, and you know, you can draw parallels between Toller's character and Schrader. He'd probably disagree and just say that it's a character, but I think all characters in all fiction are imbued with at least some of that authorial voice. But I think that's that. The salvation, quote unquote, I keep using that word, and I don't mean it in the strictly Jesus-y way, is really important, because otherwise this I don't think this is a film without hope.
No, I don't either. And Jonty, there's one other thing I would love to say, and you brought it up earlier, and you said to me, Ness, did you notice that he went from wearing a black robe when he had the vest on, going to blow himself up? And then he realises that Amanda is there in the... Mary is there in the church. So he changes into a white robe after he's put the barbed wire on his body. And I wonder if that's the author signifying to us the resurrection of Christ, because that is depicted in the images of white, gleaming white, yet it's
with that,
stained.
Those spots of blood coming through.
Through, just seeping through. So he's a tarnished, broken man who has sought redemption, I believe, in the end. And
some would say through Mary. And if you're reading it through that Catholic lens, then absolutely, through the Virgin Mary.
Oh, my gosh, Jonty.
Yeah.
What a movie. Got to get it.
Absolutely.
Got to see it.
We watched it on iTunes. We rented it, so you can rent it there. I have a DVD at home. I don't think there is a Blu-ray in Australia.
Do not rent it out, because you'll never get it back, and you hate that.
Oh, yeah. I'm not giving it out. Sorry. Because it's the only copy that I have. If A24 are listening, any A24 executives, please release a Blu-ray in Australia, because I want to see it. I want a high-definition copy of it, not a shitty DVD. If we're going to give it... Let's do it a really quick, arbitrary rating to really sum up the however long we've just been discussing in a really non-committal way.
Yeah.
Because I love ratings in a love-hate sort of way. They mean nothing to me. What would you rate it out of 10? Or 5 stars. Let's give it a rating out of 5.
4 stars.
Oh, wow. Mm. I was expecting you to give it a 2 or a 2.5.
No. No, it's a good movie. I'd watch it in the daytime, though. It's definitely not a 9 o'clock at night one.
Yeah, we watched it in the sunlight.
Yeah, definitely. You've got to be able to debrief with somebody after it. It's not... It's because it's heavy. It's deeply heavy.
It is.
You've got to... And I took a break in between, and so I'd take a break in between because it's heavy themes.
Yeah, for sure. I think,
and it's a thinking movie.
Yeah.
And I said to you, or Jonty, the one I've picked for you to watch and will review is not... I don't think of it as a deep thinking movie. I had to concentrate the whole way through it. Like, took notes and had to concentrate. I had to ask Jonty to put on subtitles so I could be listening and reading all at the same time.
So you didn't miss anything.
Yeah, it's heavy.
Yeah. Well, and I think if I were to rate it, I'd probably similar, 4 or 4.5 out of 5. But I think regardless of whether or not I like it, or if regardless of whether or not anyone, quote unquote, likes it, I think it's really, really important to be challenged. And this is a movie... We were having a look at some reviews afterwards to see what other people had written about it. and I remember you read me out loud, someone said, this is a film that takes spirituality and religion more seriously than any mainstream film in the last 20 years. And I think that is... I often... And this... I could well have done Event Central about this already when this comes out, I don't know, but I'm going to reiterate it if I already have. It's super important to not get comfortable and continue to be challenged, and cinema is somewhere where that can happen.
Mm.
And it gives me the shits to no end when Christians point at movies and say, you shouldn't watch that.
Mm.
Why not? It's fiction. Engage with the idea. Dislike it if you want. That's fine. But a film like this, which, you know, in a traditional sense, you know, it has a fairly graphic aftermath of a suicide scene. It has some very heavy ideas. I feel is one of the more profound religious quote-unquote experiences that I've had in the last 10 years is seeing this film for the first time and thinking about it for about 3 months afterwards.
I think the spirituality component in the movie, and he treats it really well.
Mm.
And it's beautifully weaved into this entire story and this guy's life. And just to watch this character struggle with his faith and to struggle with his mental health and to struggle with suicide, the thoughts of that, and abortion and his marriage ending and his kid dying.
Climate catastrophe thrown in there as well.
Thematically, yeah. It's rich.
Mm.
And for that alone, you should watch this movie.
Mm. And I think really importantly for me, it's not a film that asks you to engage in these thematic ideas and then follows it up with, and this is how you should respond.
No.
It just leaves you in it.
Oh, the ending, man.
It just, yeah.
Black screen.
Yeah. Exactly.
Bam. It's like, whoa.
Yeah. Which I think is important.
Yeah, I felt like my shoulders could relax and I could sigh out my air when that happened at that point. It's like, oh, it's over. Thank God.
So I feel like we should wrap up. We've been going for long enough. I feel like we could keep talking about this. I could certainly keep talking about this movie for a while.
I feel richer for seeing it, so thank you.
Oh, of course. Of course. If you have seen it, we would love to know what you think. We would love to know what you think. If you've seen it or if you haven't seen it, go and watch it and then tell us what you think. Because, I think it's outstanding. It's, you know, I think it only made $500,000 profit. Like, it's not a big movie and it's, you know, boxy 4:3 aspect ratio and mostly just people talking. But if you want a challenge, if you want to go watch a movie that'll make you think, definitely, definitely go and see it.
Don't have a wine and watch it. You've got to be awake. You're going to have a cappuccino.
Let us know. We'd love to know what you thought about the movie. Also, let us know if you like us talking about movies. We've got another one planned.
Yeah.
If you like listening to... I mean, I think I've enjoyed talking about movies. Have you?
Yeah, that was fun.
Yeah. We've got at least one more on the way. If you like it, let us know. We'll do some more.
Awesome.
But yeah, that's about it. First Reformed, go and see it and have your mind blown, or at least challenged.
Yeah. See you next time, Jonty.
See you next time. Catch ya. Hey, guess what? We're not perfect, so an amendment does need to be made. During that discussion, I referred to Paul Schrader as being Catholic. This, in fact, isn't true. Schrader was a Calvinist initially before converting to the Episcopal Church, a US member of the Worldwide Anglican Communion. We hope you enjoyed that discussion. As mentioned at the beginning of the podcast, that concludes our first season. But we'll be back again next week, kicking off our next series on intimacy and sexuality, where we have the conversations and ask the questions about sex and surrounding topics that we almost never do in the church. But until then, we love hearing from our listeners, and we do read all the messages and comments that we receive. So please don't hesitate to get in touch with any stories, questions, vent centrals, or anything else that you might want to send us. You can do that at filthyhopepod@gmail.com, or you can find us on Instagram or Facebook. We even have a private Facebook discussion group. Links to all those are in the description and show notes. We hope you have a great week, and we'll see you again next week for our first deep dive into the world of intimacy and sexuality. This podcast is a Uniting Heart and Soul production.